from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is the Artistic Heart Podcast, a podcast with an artistic heart and soul, with Anna Mead and Jack Wallen.
Hi, and welcome back to the Artistic Heart Podcast, the podcast with heart and soul in art. I'm Anna Mead, and I'm here with Jack Wallen.
Hello.
Our topic today is finding the story you want to tell, no matter what the medium, which is also known as crop rotation.
Yeah.
What do you think about this topic, Jack?
What's interesting, because especially given what I just recently went through, and that Eye Profundus has been filmed, and in fact, this is the last weekend to view it. Now, of course, when people are listening to this, it will be well past that time. So it doesn't really matter whether or not I'm trying to market this or not, but it has a very particular meaning to me right now, because I was able to kind of use all three of the art forms that I love so very much. Writing fiction, playwriting, writing fiction, and the theater. Now, I wasn't acting this time, I was directing, and it had been a very long time since I directed, so I was very fortunate that I was directing someone who he and I spoke the same language.
Right.
And we were able to accomplish what we needed to accomplish without any drama or issues. And it was very seamless and effortless, really. But I think this topic is far more important than even we probably gave it the necessary weight when we came up with it. Because I discovered a number of things when traversing these boundaries between art forms. And I could talk about them on different levels. For example, because I had been so far removed from directing, because the last thing I directed was like 92.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in grad school, if that tells you anything. It wasn't just that. It was that the stakes weren't very high, because I was in school and I didn't have to sell anything, you know, it was because it was isolated in that environment. So, but the thing is that when you exist isolated as an artist with one medium, you don't quite understand from the perspective of the other mediums. So when I was able to step away from being an actor and put on my director's hat, I was able to view the process from a completely different perspective and go and think, okay, I've been in the shoes of the actor. So I know the language that they're speaking, but I also know that I have to get to this one particular point in time so that the production is a success.
Is it like a matter of like pulling the lens back, do you think?
Well, it's like pulling the lens back. But the thing is because I already speak this one particular language, I was able to direct the show as an actor and go, okay, I know what you're getting, what you're going for. Mm-hmm. I know why you're going for it. But for example, in this particular moment, what you're going for isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to put myself into the shoes of the actor, because I've been an actor for so many years.
Right.
But conversely, I can also look at this in such a way that when I go back to being an actor on stage, I know what directors have to go through.
Yeah.
And when a director says to me, this isn't working, or this isn't reading, I can all of a sudden go, okay, it's not about my ego.
Oh yeah, I said that.
it's not about my ego. It's not that what I'm doing sucks. It's that what I'm doing doesn't quite jibe with what the director wants. Mm-hmm. So I just have to approach it differently. And it's really freeing to see from that lens, because all of a sudden you realize that there are so many elements. Because as an actor, you kind of have one job.
Mm-hmm.
As a director, you don't have to worry about anything else. No,
you just have to worry about your own props.
Right.
Your costume.
But as a director, you have to worry about all of these different things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they all have to work together. So as an actor, when a director comes to you and says, this isn't working,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to go, oh my gosh, I suck.
I suck.
I'm such an imposter. You can all of a sudden go, okay, you can justify it by, you know, what I'm doing wasn't working with something that I'm not seeing. So it makes a huge difference. But then there's also the other aspect of being a writer, and the show that I wrote was a one person show, but it's all dialogue. It was mm-hmm. all monologue. And what was really nice about that was I've known this for a long time, and I've written other plays, but this play in particular proved to me beyond a shadow of a doubt that I know how to write dialogue.
Yeah. Well,
and
you don't have much choice in a one person play.
No, you don't. You don't. And I've always known that it's been my strength, but at the mm-hmm. same time now, and in fact, what I started as soon as that show was over, I was back to writing another book mm-hmm. and I started looking at dialogue differently, because I had a tendency prior to rely heavily on dialogue. And now I'm like, okay, I need to even this out a little bit. I need to have a kind of an even schmear of narration, of description and dialogue. And I think that finding that balance is really important. And so I find that when you step into a different medium, when you try to tell a story with a different medium, you learn something that you weren't seeing when you were isolated to your primary medium. And those lessons are so important for artists.
Yes. I mean, I think that's absolutely sort of at the heart of what we're wanting to talk about today, because it's easy to get stuck.
Yeah, it really is.
To label yourself, well, I'm an actor, I'm a director, I'm a dancer, I'm this, I'm yeah. that. And to feel like that's the only place you're good at. Well, I'm you know, I'm a writer, but I couldn't do anything else. You know, I'm an actor and, oh, I could never direct. And that may not be your strong suit, and that's okay. Not everybody has to do every art form. But if you are feeling stuck in your artistic career, it's mm-hmm. maybe time to rotate the crops, right? It's
right.
maybe time to try something else.
Yeah.
And it may be a temporary thing. Like it might be like you need to spend an afternoon painting and then you're yeah. like, wow, I'm glad I'm primarily an actor because I'm
right.
a terrible
right, exactly. That's me.
But this idea that all of our artistic output has to be exceptional is a horrible one. I despise that idea. That idea that if you create something that you feel like is not up to the standards of what you expect or what the world would expect. Like you created something that wasn't in existence a moment ago. Like that's worth its own thing.
Yeah.
This idea you have to sell your art or it has to be like acknowledged in some major way for it to have value is a fallacy.
Right. It's interesting. And while you were talking, I hit on something here. And it's interesting. If you watch any given television series that has been around, that's been in existence for multiple seasons,
mm-hmm.
at some point in time, you can guarantee that, like when it hits season 5, 6, or 7, it's almost a 100% guarantee that you're going to start seeing the actors directing episodes.
Yeah. You know what? That's right.
Mm-hmm. They do. And I think that happens because of this very reason. They get stuck in a rut with this character
mm-hmm.
and they want to branch out. And sometimes, and you, we've all, well, many of us have wished to have this problem, that we're on a television series that's been going on for so long.
Yeah, I was going to say, one that's been going on for a decade,
right,
if only.
You know, and it's like, I can't do this anymore. And you drop out of the series. It happens all the time. And so some actors, instead of just jumping ship, they say, hey, let me direct an episode. And, mm-hmm. and part of the times what they're doing is they're either wanting to step back and just learn a different trade, or mm-hmm. they're wanting to just break the monotony, or maybe yeah. they're looking into the future going, I better have more skills than just being an actor.
Well, that's an interesting thing you say, because it's a slightly different equation for actors that identify as female, because we are definitely seen to have an expiration date. So many women of a certain age do go into directing, do go into writing, do switch their crop, because they're not seen as valuable anymore if they're no longer the ingenue, right?
Right. Now, I hope that that's changing.
I hope so.
And I think that we are starting to see that change, because I have been, because I watch a lot of television and movies,
mm-hmm.
and I have seen over this past couple of years that we're witnessing a shift. Now, it's not going to happen 100%, and it's not going to happen overnight. But there have been instances where I've started watching something new, and my first instinct is to think, wow, that is refreshing to see someone who just two years ago would never have played this role in this show.
Right.
Because of the way they look, mm-hmm. or, you know, or their age. There's a new show on HBO Max called Hacks.
And yeah, you mentioned
it's
it before,
very
yeah.
funny. It's very funny. And it's, I can't even think of her name. She was in Designing Women.
Is it the blonde?
Yes, the blonde that was in Designing Women.
She's wonderful. I cannot.
She is wonderful. Name. She stars in the series. She's an older comedian, mm-hmm. and she's absolutely
wonderful. Is it Jean Smart?
Jean Smart, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And she's absolutely wonderful. And she has an assistant kind of foisted on her. And the assistant is very much a Gen Z kind of millennial, kind of frumpy looking young woman. But it's first and foremost, it's so, and she plays a lesbian on the show. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to see that. Because mm-hmm. 2 years ago, that actor would never have been cast in that role. They would have mm-hmm. cast somebody that was beautiful and fit the mold, mm-hmm. and all. Yeah. And all of a sudden, and I think that we know part of the reason why this mold has been broken. I think Harvey is a big reason why this mold has been broken. But
one
it should have been,
many, yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
It should have been broken a long time ago. But mm-hmm. I think the gates have been cracked open a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and I think that we're going to see them open even farther. And I think we're going to see older women playing more roles. And I think we're going to see, I think that the idea of beauty is being challenged, and it should be challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's, and then that same show, there's like, for instance, the young girl's agent, his assistant, is a very heavy set woman. Mm-hmm. And the contrast between the two of them is wonderful. And the relationship, it's like, okay, that is so believable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's really important now, is this all of a sudden there's this new wave of believability that I'm seeing.
Right.
Because for so long, it just got so old. Think you're watching television and movies,
attractive
thinking
20-year-olds.
Those
people
just
world.
Don't. Yeah, they're not the norm.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's absolutely true. If you just sort of think about the casts of your favorite shows, right?
Yeah.
And you think about how many, like an absurd number of attractive people, and even the ones who are cast as like the plain or ordinary ones. Are still more attractive than like average.
Right.
I'm like, So to just have a little bit more reflection in the media, having, more diversity, we've talked about Bridgerton before, and, it is absolute 100% fluff, but to see like these beautiful, strong Black men and women in these roles that are like dukes and lords and ladies and, things that they were denied in history. It's amazing. It feels so good to watch.
But at the same time, they're still beautiful.
Oh, well, that's true. It's not they're still part of the 1%, and they're rarely old. There are some notable exceptions, and I say old very freely because unfortunately, in our art form, 35 plus is considered old.
Right.
You will see yourself start to get cast as like Auntie M.
Or... I'm kind of very fortunate there because of my height.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm short.
Well, men are beautiful forever. That's just sort of the agreement.
I don't necessarily agree with that statement because I know some pretty.
Well, yeah. I was thinking.
The problem is that men may visually age gracefully, but in some cases, they mentally and socially and emotionally, they don't.
Yeah. Well, that is a good distinction for sure. Yeah. There was some TV show I saw where it was, I don't even remember what it was, but it was a husband and wife pair and they were the same age. And it was really striking to me because you never see that, right?
Right. It's always a younger woman.
The leads are always going to be the older man and the extremely young woman. And the secondary characters, you usually see them matched up with people like way inappropriately younger.
Yeah.
Like, and it's not even like we're so used to it that it is striking when you have two middle-aged people married to each other. You're like, oh. Hey, yeah, that's a lot of times what happens.
Well, here's something really, really fascinating that I just thought of. I watched a movie called The Woman in the Window this week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Amy Adams.
I love her.
Now, I think Amy Adams is probably one of the finest actors Hollywood has.
Oh, absolutely. She's excellent.
She is absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And she is so far away from the Hollywood standard
that
in this movie, she's frumpy. She looks like she doesn't have any makeup on, but at the same time, she's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that beauty is just her absolute talent. And some of it is just, there's confidence. And, beauty comes from so many different things.
It does.
It's not just external because we all know that beauty fades, there was another fantastic example is the mayor of East Town, I think.
Oh, yeah. I want to watch that with Kate
and
Winslet.
I can't even think Kate Winslet. Mm-hmm. And, Kate Winslet, she's not the Kate Winslet that you remember from Titanic.
No, in fact, I think she railed against like what she was forced into by Hollywood, like had controlled.
You're watching this series, and you're like, I don't care. It's freaking Kate Winslet.
She's another excellent actor.
Yeah,
but I mean, we still have to think about this, Jack. The two examples you just gave of women who are not conventionally attractive to Hollywood are actually completely stunning women, right? We're still talking about white, youngish, able-bodied women, right? Who even though by Hollywood standards, they're not sort of your standard, like blonde, whatever. That's sort of the best we can point at, really. It's like, do we often see somebody that would be considered like ugly by society standards in
the first
roles?
Person I could think of is Booger.
Is who?
I think it was Revenge of the Nerds. He played Booger and he was in Moonlighting, and he's a fairly, and I hate to say that, but he's by normal standards, he's an unattractive man,
right. Mm-hmm.
But he's worked. He's worked for decades.
I mean, character actors. We've talked about this before. Well, yeah. Like if you got to be not the most beautiful, you got to be a character actor. Right.
But here's really what it boils down to. If you're not beautiful, you damn well better be talented.
Well, that's right. And so when you have beauty and talent, like you do with Amy Adams and Kate Winslet, it's worth noting, right?
Right. And but I think that the Hollywood standard is crumbling. Not mm-hmm. crumbling as fast as we'd like it to, but it is. But at the same time, and, you know, getting back to the original subject is that, you know, that's kind of a crop rotation that Hollywood's just going to have to accept.
That's right.
It's mm-hmm. not just, they're just going to have to rotate out the idea of what is beauty, what is talent, what, you know, and, you know, gender stereotypes are just going to have to go away. All of the stereotypes are just going to have to go
right.
by the wayside.
Absolutely.
And Hollywood has to, and it's not, and there are so many other things. And one of the things is that this is a very exciting time for art. And I know it sounds kind of antithetical for what we've been through, mm-hmm. but one thing that this pandemic has done is it showed us that entertainment can be done on the cheap.
Right.
And Hollywood has to grab that by the ankles and go, we accept this. And you know, one of the biggest problems that Hollywood has had is that they feel like in order to have a successful television show, they have to spend an inordinate amount of money, and then they cast people, and then those people, even if they're no names, eventually that show will become popular, and those who were previously no names can all of a sudden start demanding more and more money. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Big Bang Theory was one of the biggest guilty parties of that. All of a sudden you have these people that before the show, no one knew their names. Mm-hmm. And now they're all of a sudden demanding $1 million per episode. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you're not that talented. And you're not that beautiful.
Cast members of Big Bang Theory, if you're listening to this, we still love you.
We do. I watched every episode of that show, and I related to that show on mm-hmm. a profound level. And I'm glad that show happened. And like, for example, Katie Cuoco, she was okay in Big Bang mm-hmm. Theory, but then she did that other series, The Flight Attendant, and she was fantastic.
Yeah, and she voiced Harley Quinn in the animated series.
Yeah. She is one of those instances where she was so much better than the show that made
material.
Her famous.
And well, so part of that is because you don't have enough diversity in the writing room. You don't have enough diversity in the director pool. And once you start injecting different people who look different, people who are different, people who have a different worldview, you start getting some really interesting results, right? We need more Black directors. We need more queer directors. We need more of this, more than that, more than that.
And even beyond that, one of the problems that a lot of television shows have is that they stick with the same writers all the time. You know, and it's like...
That's dull after five seasons. You're like, we've seen this. A lot of times.
It's why so many shows fail after four or five seasons. Mm-hmm. Just rotate your writers. Go out and find new writers. I'll promote myself a little bit, but there are a lot of writers out there that are perfectly capable, more than capable, of doing that task.
Right.
And the problem is that Hollywood just wants to eat their own. It's like, you know.
Yeah, it's very circular.
Yeah, it's like reach beyond your little clique mm-hmm. and find unique sources. You know, sometimes they've cast an actor who they found them in you know, unique ways. They didn't go through the traditional routes, and they found a gem.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood might want to consider not hiring Hollywood writers, and they might solve some of their problems.
I agree, because if they never reach outside, I mean, I think one of the things that really burns my buns is like when you see this situation where relatively unknown, untested people, generally white men, are given the opportunity on a show or a movie, and it flops, and they're given another opportunity and another
and another mm-hmm. and another. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's a hit, but it's like anyone else who tries that, and if it's somehow deemed a failure by the studio, that person doesn't get a second chance.
Right, right. I think that one of the things that Hollywood and even theaters could probably do this as well. They need to change up their recruiting methods. What the way it is now, it's like and I know that especially like Lort theaters feel this mm-hmm. way, that they are a very, very special clique.
Mm-hmm.
And this club that they have, you have to find the way to get to them.
Right.
In order to get
they're
a chance.
They're not going
to
open the door for you.
What they need to do more than open the door. They need to start pretending like they're a NBA team or something like that and mm-hmm. go scouting for people.
They need to have,
you know, big agencies in Hollywood should be going out to regional theaters and small theaters and watching shows and saying, oh, that guy's really talented or that lady is really talented. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get them into our office.
Right.
And they don't do that. And, you know, it's like, why not? It's free. All you have to do is pay for a ticket, maybe a plane ticket.
Because it requires effort and it requires going outside your comfort zone, which most exactly. people refuse.
And I get this. Here is the catch-22 with this situation. Movies and TV they're really expensive to produce. And most production studios don't want to risk anything. That's why they cast Tom Cruise in everything. At some point, we're going to have a movie that Tom Cruise plays every role.
Every part.
Because for some strange reason, they believe that Tom Cruise is an automatic hit regardless of what he's done or what mm-hmm. what he's doing. So they just cast him to be safe. And then they have to pay Tom Cruise money to get Tom Cruise.
Right.
And so we've reached a point where they're not rotating their crops enough because they're afraid of taking a chance. And you know what? We've reached a point now, I think, where society is a little smarter than that. And
I hope.
we've seen so many indie films lately. Like, for mm-hmm. example, one of the biggest horror movies over the last few years is Host. And Host was nobody knew anybody in that film. It was very low budget. And it was massive. It's a massive hit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so well done. And that's just the thing. If you do it well, it doesn't matter who's in it.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
and sometimes I don't like seeing actors I know really well. It takes me out of it, right?
Yeah.
If I see an actor that I consider not the greatest fit, you know, I'm like, oh, why did they cast that person? And they might be able to prove otherwise. But like, if I don't know the actor, I'm coming with like sort of an open mind and a fresh slate,
yeah.
right?
And it's the same thing as an artist. You know, if you find yourself in a rut in your art, it's time to do something else.
Right.
It's time if you're an actor and you're getting cast in the same roles all the time, or you just mm-hmm. you've lost the thrill or whatever, you know, go direct something, go write something, go draw something. Mm-hmm. And even you may not think that you have the skill to do it, but as long as you do it to the best of your ability, you're going to learn something from it.
Well, I won't say nobody, but almost no one is good at a new skill instantly.
No.
And for perfectionists, that's a real struggle.
It is. It really
is. If you try something and you fail or you don't do very well, you get embarrassed. You're like, oh, mm-hmm. wow, you know, I can't do this. Well, that's not true. And the things that you're really wonderful at one point you were new at that too.
Right, exactly. Do you remember the very first show you ever did,
okay.
and how you felt?
Mm-hmm.
And it was I remember very well. I was scared to death. I was scared to death to walk into the audition because I didn't know anybody. I didn't.
Yeah,
I had never. And my very first audition was a musical, and I had never sung in public. I was in band. I played tuba, and I went into this audition and I sang a popular song. I had never sung with an accompanist before.
Oh my.
So the accompanist had to play the melody along with me. Here's the thing though, and I think that this is what saved me, is because it was so new, I had no expectation. I did not know. I just assumed that everybody went about it the same way.
Right.
And because I did that, I was able to walk up in front of that crowd and just do what I did.
It allows for fear and fearlessness.
Yeah. And I think that, and this is a big, big problem with so many artists. They are so afraid. And you've got to, I mean, think about it this way. As an actor, you stand in front of an audience. You have to have a certain level of fearlessness for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a combination of fearlessness and ego and desire and, mm-hmm. And self-flagellation and we,
masochism.
Go ahead, we just it's so many things, but we still do it. And if you can stand in front of an audience and play Hamlet or Ophelia or whoever, you can at least try any artistic endeavor, because the fear that you should normal humans would experience a great amount of fear standing in front of a couple thousand people to play Hamlet.
There are people who would rather, like, they say what they would rather be like shot than
exactly.
They would want to be stage.
And as an actor, that's second nature to you.
Right.
Facing down that fear is you do it with ease.
Well, and there's that kind of like feel good motivational posters, like, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? Well, what if you do fail? Right. Like, what if you do? Like,
you learn
that's
something.
Human. We don't get through life without failing. You won't learn anything if you don't fail.
I always approach it like this. I don't really learn much from my successes. I do learn a lot from my failures.
Mm-hmm. Or partial failures,
doesn't have to be a complete failure to
teach you.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if I do something and it's a complete failure, I learn that I probably shouldn't do that again. If I do something and it's a moderate failure, I can step back and go, okay, this is what I did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't like to approach it with this is what I did right, because I'm not going to learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to learn a lot from this is what I did wrong.
So I guess the takeaway for this topic of like finding the story you want to tell, if you are feeling stuck, it's just try something else, try something new, and don't be afraid. Like, even if you identify so strongly with one particular art form, you're like, well, I'm a musician, I'm not this, right?
Right.
I'm a writer, I'm not this.
Yeah.
You may discover a hidden talent, or you may just discover that, gosh, you're darn glad to go back to your original art form because this other one's too hard.
Right. You may not be a triple threat. But
yeah.
A lot of people
aren't. I would say I'm like a 2.5 threat.
Yeah. There's absolutely nothing wrong with saying I'm an actor who sings and an actor who moves.
Mm-hmm.
As same thing, there's nothing wrong with saying I'm a singer who can act.
Right.
A dancer who can sing.
Sing, yeah.
You know, I'm an actor who can sing and move.
I think it's good to have a good picture of yourself. It's just that so few of us do, right? It's very hard to get sort of a self-actualization to that level where you're like, wow, this is what I do really well.
Yeah. And here, the problem with that is that you either are on one camp or another. You have absolutely no idea what you're good at or bad at, and you just assume you're really good at everything. Or you've had your ego beaten down and you just assume you're not good at anything. Or you're really good at one thing and you just suck at everything else. And that's where I was for a long time. I knew I was a good actor, but I always assumed that I just was a horrible singer and a horrible dancer. And it steered my life in a certain direction for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just have to be realistic. And sometimes realistic isn't just to say, okay, I'm not really good at this. Sometimes realistic is actually saying, okay, I'm okay at that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd say most of the people we know are actually, the problem is that they believe they're not good at anything.
Yeah.
It becomes an opposite of ego thing where they cannot claim their true talents, right?
Yeah.
They can't acknowledge it.
you know, it's hard to know how much of that is like brought from society, like you don't need to brag, versus how much of it is like brought from like a genuine belief that what you're doing is no good.
Right. You have agency over your ego.
Yeah.
You can, it's okay to accept the fact that you are talented. And there's a huge difference between accepting what everyone else sees and being egotistical about it.
Well, in our Facebook group that we've created, which I'll put a plug in for that here, it's called Beyond the Artistic Heart. Mm-hmm. And we want you to join it. We want you to continue the conversation with us past the podcast. We want you to come and read other people's thoughts, know that you're not alone, share your own, so on. But, you know, one of the things that we talked about on that group is that many people are indoctrinated not to speak of their accomplishments.
Yeah.
And that becomes a whole thing. And I think eventually want to do an episode just kind of focusing on that. Yeah. But you have to believe in yourself to a certain extent, or you're not going to be able to do all this, right?
If you don't believe in yourself and you stand in front of auditors to perform a monologue for an audition, you are going to fail.
Yes.
You have got to be able to believe in your talents and your that you belong. And you know, it's hard because not just this country, in many countries, we are taught to not feel that level of pride in ourselves. Mm-hmm. Now think about, let's just put it in a different perspective here. Do you think that someone like LeBron James at night tells himself, I'm no good?
Presumably not. I don't want to speak for LeBron, but...
There is, at some point in your career as an artist, you just have to at least accept what the public says about you. And, you know, if the masses are saying, oh my gosh, this person is brilliant, it's okay to accept that.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you should walk around going, right? Yeah. If everybody agrees, it's probably truth. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean you should be walking around going, I'm brilliant. I'm the world's most brilliant actor. No, don't do that.
Yeah, don't swing the other way too far.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, at some point you just have to go, okay. I'm not going to argue with everyone. And I'm at least going to accept the fact that I know what I'm doing.
All right, so we're here as usual, pushing our time. What do we think should be the takeaways for this episode?
That when you're in a rut, a very good way to get out of that rut is to try something different. And I don't mean just instead of doing a comic monologue, to try a dramatic monologue.
Right.
Try to direct
shades. Try a new color.
Try a completely new color. Try a completely new palette of colors. Try a different medium. Try to, you know, direct some. And, you know, if you've never directed before, the chances of you actually getting to direct a main stage show are slim to none.
Direct
Don't expect that.
Show. I mean,
direct a student show.
Get your friends together and do. I mean, when we're little, that's what we do, right?
Right.
We
put
on little plays.
Right. Well, when we're little, we're fearless.
All right.
And what happens is at some point in our lives, we learn to fear failure. I don't know a child that is afraid of failure because they don't really know what failure is.
Right.
As adults, we profoundly know what failure is.
Mm-hmm. Humiliating.
Because failure could mean the difference of putting food on the table or not.
Yeah.
And so you just have to, as an artist, I think probably the most important thing to take away from this is to govern your failure and not let your failure rule your life.
Or because define what that means for you permanently, right?
Yeah. Don't let failure define you, period.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to fail. You are going to fail. You're an artist. It's inevitable. At some point, you're going to do something and it's going to bomb.
But that's what makes us special.
Right.
I mean, not to sound too new agey about it, but like for people who are artistic and in the arts versus people who are not interested in any way in creating something, yeah. that is what makes us special.
Yeah. That, you know, we have to embrace our failures.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and here's a great thing. Here's an absolutely great thing. I have at times been known to fail. And when I fail, there's been at least one instance where I have known something has failed. And I have taken that failure and moved it over to another art form and turned it into a success.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great idea. I have a novel I've been working on and it was failing in third person and I've switched it to first person and it's so much better.
Yeah.
And I had this idea that like, well, I usually write in first person. I should write in third person. Well, I did, and it just didn't sing the way it does in first person.
Here's a great story about that. My best-selling book is iZombie I, which is the first book in the iZombie series. And when I first wrote that book, it was the first horror novel I ever wrote. And I came up with this great idea that I was going to write this book in first-person present tense.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized very quickly during the writing of that, oh, how is he writing in first person present tense when he's battling a zombie? How do I get around that? So I thought, okay, he's got a recorder. Since he's a journalist, he's got a recorder with him. And this recorder's recording all the time. So he can go back and he can fill in the blanks.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this entire book like that. And when I sent it off to the editor said, hey, this isn't working. We have to rewrite this entire book in third person.
Oh, yeah.
Or in first person past tense. And it was like, you're kidding me. And it took me a long time to rewrite that book. And but it was worth it. And the editor was right. So I took that failure and turned it into a success. And all I had to do was switch it from first person present tense to first person past tense. Now, when I say all I had to do, it was a Herculean effort, but it worked. And, you know, that's just one little example of turning a failure into a success. And sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. In this case, it worked. So, you know, learn from your failures. And I learned that first person present tense is probably not a good idea for fiction.
It is definitely tricky. I've not actually seen it done successfully. That doesn't mean that no one on this planet can, but it's very hard.
You can do it for like flash fiction,
mm-hmm.
monologues, obviously, mm-hmm. but a long form fiction, it's really challenging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for joining us today for the Artistic Heart. Be sure to join our Facebook group called Beyond the Artistic Heart. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Ruana3. Jack, what's your handle?
JL Wallen.
J.L. Wallen. Okay.
Not Mullen. Well, I'm not Mullen. Not Mullen.
W-A-L-L-E-N. Wallen.
Right. Although I've been known on occasions to maul people. Yeah. Put some peanut butter in front of me and I'll maul it.
Thanks for joining us today. And we look forward to you listening next time.
Thank you very much, everybody. The Artistic Heart Podcast is produced by Anna Mead and me, Jack Wallen. It's distributed by Louisville Public Media. Our theme song was written and performed by Craig Waits. To suggest a topic or ask questions, feel free to reach us on Twitter at either JL Wallen or RUANA3.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.